Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Charlotte Higgins. Charlotte is The Guardian's chief culture writer and the author of 6 books. Her most recent, Greek Myths, A New Retelling, was published last year. It tells the stories of the Greek myths through the figures of 8 women, and is illustrated by the Turner Prize-winning artist, Chris Ofili. Charlotte, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you. Your Greek Myths is one of my favourite books of this year. From its introduction to the stories to the illustrations, it's such a complete and beautiful work of both scholarly interest and art, but is a retelling of the Greek and Roman myths that we know so well. You take the stories of 8 mythical women and use them to tell other mythical stories through the act of their weaving. You write about a connection between weaving and writing. The Latin etymology of the word text comes from a word that means to weave. Do you want to talk about this connection between weaving and storytelling and how it was to use weaving as a central conceit in the book?
Yeah, sure. And thank you very much indeed for having me on the podcast, Francesca. Yeah, I mean, this idea of weaving and tapestries as a central containing device for the stories, well, it really came from the original thought that, I mean, it's a very practical thought, actually, that I wanted some way of shaping and containing and editing, really, the stories that were going to be in the book, because there is such an immense profusion of possibilities in classical literature, and so many, I mean, an infinite number. I mean, you could really spend, you could spend the rest of your life writing a kind of infinite, you know, Borgesian tome on Greek myths. And I didn't want to just sort of have one story after another for no particular reason. I quite like a high concept structural device that helps me, you know, it both constricts and restrains in a way. I quite like that. And so I sort of thought about what that might be. And that, and as always, I'm looking at, I mean, I studied Greek and Latin literature, I studied classics at university. So I've been thinking about these texts for a very long time, the source texts, and thinking through, looking at Greek and Roman literature and thinking, well, what kind of devices did they use? And, you know, the most obvious and the most brilliant is Ovid's Metamorphoses, where Ovid selected myths that related to transformations, mythical transformations, and forms them into an incredible epic scale poem that is itself transformative in the sense that it's so beautifully and seamlessly kind of magically keeps its subject going. You know, it metamorphoses itself. It is itself a poetic act of metamorphosis. So it's a kind of beautiful meeting of form and function. So I kind of thought, well, I'm not going to be the next Ovid. I mean, let's be real here. But I liked the idea that I could perhaps find some kind of structural device that, in which form and function were fairly connected and entwined. And of other, you know, there are other Greek texts and Roman texts that collect mythical stories together. I mean, there was actually a Homeric text that brought together stories about, I mean, it's fragmentary now, almost lost, but brought together stories about female characters, although actually mostly as a kind of dynastic, you know, as mothers of heroes and wives of heroes. And there were mythical texts that brought together myths about stars and astronomy and the nature and origin of constellations. There were texts that brought together myths about birds. I mean, a lot of these, as I say, are kind of fragmentary now. So there were plenty of kind of possibilities, but I was very struck. I mean, this came from, you know, my knowledge of Greek literature and Roman literature, but also reading academic essays and so on, that there are extraordinary moments in classical literature in which female characters take narrative agency through the act of weaving. So one hugely obvious example is that of Penelope, who, when she's at home in Ithaca, waiting endlessly for her husband Odysseus to return, she's sort of besieged by suitors who want to marry her. She delays the moment of choice, choosing a new husband by a kind of device, which is, she says, I will choose a husband when I've finished weaving my father-in-law's shroud. And so every day she weaves and every night she unweaves. And so one question might be, what was Penelope weaving? Or what was Penelope unweaving? Which actually named a brilliant essay written in the 1980s by an academic called Caroline Harbron, which was really helpful and influential. But there are other examples like Arachne and Minerva in Ovid's Metamorphoses holding a weaving competition. And Arachne's choice of design is very pointed. And, you know, it's not just any old stories she depicts on that tapestry of myths. It's stories that make her point to the goddess, and the goddess weaves very pointed designs in her tapestry as well. So there was this idea of tapestries being incredibly meaningful. So that was a starting point.
Yeah, I think that's so fabulous. And I think what I was really struck by is how many different sources of Greek myths you could have chosen from Homer to Ovid to Hesiod to everyone, and also all those fragmentary texts you were talking about. If Ovid's Metamorphoses and Ovid's Herodes were kind of key texts, because there are so many versions of each different Greek myth, how did you go about collating versions or choosing versions?
Well, I read really widely, and then actually it was partly the process of once I'd identified my suitable narrators, the question of what would Penelope want to weave was very helpful, and then sort of inviting me to choose certain versions or certain texts. What if Athena was weaving a story of the beginning of the universe, you know, what would she choose to depict? And so that was part of the point. You know, those two things came together, that kind of selection process via the structural format were very closely linked. But I think at a kind of molecular level, it was actually very instinctive a lot of the time, once you're in the zone. I mean, for me, which was a wonderful place to be, because it's such a different way of writing for me. As you said, I'm chief culture writer at The Guardian. I am a non-fiction writer ostensibly of journalism, and all my other books have been sort of straightforwardly non-fiction. Perhaps I've been moving away slightly from straightforward non-fiction, but because I wrote a book about labyrinths called Red Thread, which is kind of unstraightforward and playful non-fiction. So I had been perhaps moving in this direction a little bit, but to be in the position of retelling stories, which is a very, you know, which is both a kind of rigorous thing to do, because I was, I was in lockstep with ancient sources a lot of the time, but it is also a creative act, because you're always in the position of choosing where to point the camera, what details to enlarge and focus on, what details to collapse and make more concise. And that sort of act of creative decision making about how you're going to retell a story has been ongoing since antiquity, right? So there's no original version of any of these stories. They are, by their very nature, contaminated. They're there to be retold. That's what, you know, Aeschylus, as it were, was retelling stories from Homer with a kind of radically different focus, and Sophocles was doing that, and Euripides was doing that, and this process has been a kind of live creative process right from the very beginning. So in a small way, as a Muslim person, obviously in a completely different kind of cultural and religious context, doing that, you know, you've got this sort of power surge behind you. You know, you there's a kind of invitation to creativity, but at the same time, you know, I wanted it to be a useful book, a book that was very heavily footnoted or endnoted, I should say, strictly speaking, so that readers would, you know, be sent back to the original sources, which are so kind of fabulous and amazing.
And the way you talk about how there is no one original version of the story, so a lot of people are talking about how there are so many kind of feminist retellings of classical myths at the moment, from Pat Barker to Jennifer Saint, her Ariadne. But maybe they're not retellings in any sense at all, they're just different tellings. Because if you think Ovid's Herodes is not really a feminist retelling of the Greek myths, it's a telling that puts women more at the centre, which is quite an interesting way of thinking about how they're not really retellings at all.
Yeah, and I think also you're perhaps moving towards noticing, or I mean, I'm sure you've noticed, but anyway, perhaps embedded in your question, in what you've just said, is the notion that, I mean, my book is not actually at all like those books by Pat Barker and Natalie Haynes, Madeline Miller, Jenny Saint, but all of which I've read, by the way, and all of which I, you know, I'm very keen on, because my book, you know, characters do not move through time in the same way as they would in a novel, and it's certainly not an act of, it's not an act of restitution. And I think this is potentially occasionally confused by readers who might think, well, why do you give so little, you know, you've got this sort of quasi-feminist structural device, but at the same time, you know, really bad things happen to female characters within the stories, and sometimes those female characters within the stories actually have very little agency at all. Well, that's because I'm more or less in lockstep with the sources. And sometimes I'm writing against the sources a bit, but what I'm not doing is getting like fully into the mind of Circe and giving her own kind of inner life and story and filling out the gaps between the sources. I'm kind of much more with the sources, and it's definitely not a novel. So. I mean, clearly, you know, that as you've suggested, there is kind of in a mysterious, and I don't think I can very satisfactorily explain it, but there clearly is a moment in which a lot of women writers are producing books around mythology that foreground female characters, like a little kind of little tidal wave, like a little cork has been taken out of a bottle, to use another watery metaphor.
A brilliant tidal wave. And I think it is really true to say that yours is very different to all of them in a sense. It's kind of, it's not a retelling of the stories so much as it is a telling of them just framed in a different way.
It's a compendium. I think it's in the tradition of ancient compendia of myth. So it is a retelling, but it's not a novelization.
Definitely, yeah. So you talked a while ago about how you ended up choosing the myth after you chose which women you were going to use as your narrators. Some of the narrators are very famous figures in mythology, like Penelope, Helen of Troy, Athena. How did you choose the other eight? And also, you invoke the muses at the beginning. There are famously nine muses. Why eight narrators?
Well, I had to invoke the muses. You know, I mean, various works of ancient literature start with an invocation to the muses. The Iliad starts with an invocation to the muses, as does the Odyssey. And I mean, you know, again, I'm not setting myself up as Homer, but of course it's a fabulous notion that all these branches of creativity and, you know, astronomy, history, lyric verse, and so on are presided over by these very powerful women, goddesses who were the children of memory. These very ancient goddesses are in charge of storytelling of all kinds. I had to make sure that they were happy, so I did invoke them at the beginning. Yeah, like the choice of these other women, some of whom were are super famous and well known to everyone, some of whom are really obscure. Well, I tell you what, there is one exception to what I've told you when I said I chose these women first and then as it were, assigned them stories to tell via the descriptions of the tapestries that they're weaving. The one exception to that is Thebes, the stories that relate to Thebes, which I have told by an obscure character who crops up in Ovid's Metamorphoses and also in Antoninus Liberalis's Metamorphoses, which is a much, much, much more obscure text. And actually, that was the one situation in which the cart was put before the horse, or maybe the other way around, because part of the way through planning the book, I just realised that Thebes is the most storied city in the ancient classical world. Like, so many stories sort of cling to Thebes. It sort of needed its own. It needed its own tapestry. And in that particular case, once I decided that, you know, because Thebes is the setting for Oedipus, for Antigone, for, you know, the foundation of Thebes by Cadmus. It's the scene of Euripides' play, The Bacchae. I mean, it's absolutely hooching with stories. So it seemed to need its own discrete chapter. And actually for Thebes, the difficulty was finding someone to tell the stories. So was finding a Boeotian character, Boeotian woman who wove in ancient literature. And rather brilliantly, there was this princess of Orchomenos, which is a sort of neighbouring town to Thebes, who had a wonderful story associated with her. But yes, she could hardly be accused of being a household name. And I think she's there's Philomela, she's another one. She was always going to be there because she has such a remarkable story in the Metamorphoses of Ovid. Her story is that she's raped and her tongue is cut out by her rapist, so that she can't bear witness to her story. She cannot take agency over what has happened to her at all. She can't speak. But she does speak through other means. She weaves a tapestry showing the events that occurred, and that becomes a very powerful plot device. That it's not just simply bearing witness. It forces the story. Her doing that forces the story on to a very gruesome end. So Philomela was absolutely always going to be in it.
I wanted to ask about Philomela, and this might sound like a bit of a bizarre question, but Philomela famously can't speak, and so weaves her story into the tapestry that she gives to her sister. And in describing the tapestry, you give Philomela kind of words, and I wondered how you dealt with if phrasis is the description of an artistic object in language, and it's kind of maybe what you do when you describe the tapestries, in a sense you're describing the thing rather than the action within the thing itself, if that makes sense. How did it feel to negotiate the boundary between object and words describing the object when you're very famously writing from a position or about a woman who didn't have any words?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, quite a complex one, isn't it? I suppose in general, the answer to that is that the point about ekphrasis, the description, using the description of an artistic object as a literary device, which is it's a big thing in ancient literature. So Iliad, Homer really gives us the first in the Iliad, which is the incredible description of the shield of Achilles, which is forged by Hephaestus for Achilles to use, which is decorated with incredible scenes, which are described. We forget very quickly that we are looking at a work of art. The sort of playfulness of ekphrasis is that you disappear. The mind of the reader quickly sort of amalgamates or dissolves the illusion of materiality and plays the movie in their head, not mediated by another artwork. At least that's what happens to me. And I think the big inspiration, I suppose, I want to put it that way, but a big exemplar for me was the textile that is described in 64th poem by Catullus, Catullus 64, Catullus being the first century BCE Roman poet. And his 64th poem is a mini epic, which begins with the building of the Argo, the ship that Jason's going to sail. So you think it's going to be a story about Jason and the Argonauts, but then it focuses in on one of the Argonauts and Peleus and his marriage to the goddess Thetis. And then it sort of zooms into their wedding. So you think it's going to be, you know, all of this takes a lot of handbrake turns, this poem. It focuses very clearly onto their wedding. And then it takes you through that's where the wedding is, into the central room, makes you look at the marriage bed, and on the marriage bed is this incredible textile, which is decorated with stories telling the story of Ariadne and Theseus and the Minotaur. And then nearly all the poem is a description of that tapestry. It's just telling you that story, but actually, of course, you quite quickly forget being shown something just in the story. And then the poet kind of teases you by tweaking back into the notion that it's made of thread. It's a device that points out the illusion of what the artist is doing, which I'm a sucker for that, which is why I chose to have a play with it myself. And I'm not sure that answers your question, but that's the sort of thing that was going on in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think it's something that I really noticed when I was reading the book, is you forget that you're, the large passages of the description of the tapestry, you forget that you're reading a description of what somebody else is weaving. And then I wanted to ask about the illustrations that Chris Afili did for the book, because I think they're definitely a moment where you're reminded of the fact that this is also a description of a visual object in a sense, because they're very sinuous line drawings or prints, which really remind you of threads because they're almost continuous in the way he draws them. How was it working with him to design the illustrations for the book? Did you have much impact over it?
Well, first of all, Francesca, thank you so much for that great description of them, because I think you've really got it, or you've got what I think probably we both would hope to have achieved, that you know, Chris Afili has not made a literal interpretation of the kind of tapestry idea, and you know that would, I'm not sure that could ever work, but also, you know, Chris Afili would just not, you know, he just wouldn't be interested in that kind of very literal idea. And so but it does have this metaphorical connection, I think, that exactly as you say, in the line and the very sinuous line that he has. Well, Chris, I knew slightly, very slightly. I'd interviewed him in 2012, so it's a really quite a long time now, 10 years ago, nearly. And I'd interviewed him about a project he had done with the Royal Ballet, which was to design a ballet based on Titian's painting Diana and Actaeon, right? So it was Titian's vision of a scene from Ovid, and Chris was busily getting into Ovid when we spoke. And I think actually that was a massive junction for him, because ever since that time paintings have been more and more interested in mythology, and in fact, just as Picasso did, I think he has very creatively developed a kind of whole mythological landscape of his own, that isn't a kind of literal, you know, he's not literally sitting down and illustrating scenes from Ovid, but he has a kind of sense of his own and his own mythological landscape that's also got a bit of Trinidad in it. Certainly it's a landscape of his inner world, and it's just fabulous. And he was top of my list. My editor at Jonathan Cape very wisely said to me, make a list of who you think you'd like to illustrate, and do not be constrained by who you think might say yes or not, just write the list, which was a very good piece of advice, because with my usual pessimism, I would have probably started somewhere else, so nothing fancy gained. And I wrote to him, and it was just before the first lockdown of 2020, and he a very long time to decide that he wanted to do it. I think it's characteristic of him. You know, he's very, he doesn't do things on a whim. He's incredibly thoughtful about whether he's going to do it. And, you know, that can be frustrating. I was a bit frustrated just because I wanted so much. Then we got to the point where he wanted me to read my text, read a bit of the text so that he could have it on a kind of amateurish audiobook. I think to play in the studio, or, you know, he likes to listen. Lots of painters, you know, listen to stuff in the studio in this day and age of podcasts and audiobooks. And this ended up with me reading the entire thing. It started off with me reading bits of it with a friend who's an audio producer who very kindly sort of produced quite nicely a couple of chapters, and then we went into lockdown and he asked me through the whole thing. So I was sort of in my bedroom under blankets reading this very, very rough pre-first draft thing, this entire book, probably incredibly badly, I think. But anyway, at the end of this, he said yes, which was a joyful day. I can tell you, in the very dark days of 2020, it was a joyful day when Christopher Ely agreed to illustrate the book, and, you know, I just couldn't be happier. And I've got 9 prints upstairs waiting to be hung.
Oh, that's so brilliant. They are my favourite. They are just absolutely stunning. I think they're the favourite thing of art I've seen this whole year. I wish they could have an exhibition of them.
Actually, you can go and see his gallery is Victoria Miro in London, and actually they have got all 9 of them hanging in the sort of vestibule, not the vestibule, but as you enter the gallery, there are all 9 of them hanging very nicely as prints. And I think possibly there may be, at some point will come along a fabulous exhibition of his paintings. And I don't know whether it will contain these drawings as such, but a lot of connected work because he's so infused in these ideas just at the moment. And, you know, when and if such an exhibition occurs, I shall be, you know, first in line.
Perfect. So one thing I was really interested in is a lot of the women, well, it's very hard to define chronology in Greek myths in a sense. You don't really get a sense of what happened before one, other than the generations of gods and goddesses and mortals and immortals, like family dynasties and stuff. But a lot of the women, you get the sense they're weaving stories that they kind of hear as myths, particularly in Arachne's case, for example. But that's very much a sense that she's weaving things that she knows of rather than immediately happened. But in Helen's chapter, which is incredibly moving, she's weaving things that directly happened to her and her family. And I just wanted to ask how you felt about dealing with that difficulty of time, or the fact that what she was weaving is so, so genuinely emotional for her.
Thank you. I think, yes, it's... Again, I think there's a kind of interesting feature of Greek and Roman literature that characters who we think of as mythical characters quite often start telling each other stories long ago are also myths for us. So you get this sort of rather nice feeling of, and of course it's absolutely everywhere in Ovid, because Ovid is full of embedded stories. So characters are actually always telling stories within stories within stories. So this idea that mythical characters tell each other myths is a lovely one, and one of the many attractions of working in this kind of ecstatic way. By the time we get to Helen, who's quite far on in the book, and having said that, definitely not a novel, definitely can't possibly be confused with the novel. I mean, I think that it's not like it doesn't change, I think, hopefully, it does change its nature a little bit, this book, as it progresses. There is some kind of, there's an arc of sorts, and I think it is that the narrators are a little bit closer to their own material, as you suggest, and a little bit more invested in it, and have a bit more, the way the book lands in the end with Penelope is that Penelope actually becomes rather skeptical about the nature of the stories, or questioning of the stories that she's telling. And that was very deliberate. That was nudging us into a kind of post-mythical society, or, you know, also on another level reminding us and myself that whilst the Greeks and the Romans were completely marinated in this material as cultural, social, religious stuff of their lives, they were also kind of skeptical and questioning of the existence of the gods and the nature of the gods, and that there was a way, and I don't want to ruin it too much for anyone listening who might be kind enough to think that they would possibly read the book in the future, but the end of the book plays with those notions a little bit. And I think, I'm not sure actually, Francesca, I think you've done that thing, noticing something that I hadn't really noticed as the writer of the book. And of course, that's completely fine. I mean, you know, the writer is dead, right? I mean, who cares what I intended? But I think actually this was, in a sense, what you're describing was instinctual. And I'm slightly thinking on the hoof now when I think, only the thing about Penelope, because that was a very intended and... but I hadn't really considered that idea of Helen being closer to her material. But now you mention it, you're absolutely right. It was a lot of fun writing. I mean, you know, in a way you have to throw caution to the wind, because, I mean, Helen's writing the Trojan War. And, you know, I think if you told me 3 years ago now, we're going to write the story of the Trojan War, it just feels ridiculously presumptuous. But actually being able to filter it through her... was, and think what would Helen want to say, was enormously enjoyable, actually.
I also don't want to ruin the end of the book for any readers, but because obviously so much of Penelope's story, for example, in her letter in Ovid's Herodes, is being very sceptical of the story she's hearing about her husband as well, in the sense as why is he so delayed? And for her then to become scepticism of myth-making and the weaving of her tapestry more generally is a really beautiful image. And at the end, it's really quite emotional in a sense. So I think it works incredibly well, the thread at the end and the thread in the illustrations.
Thank you. I had such fun with Penelope too, because it was just like, I just simply gave myself the exercise of telling the Odyssey from her point of view. So it was like, it was just like putting the coat of the Odyssey on inside out, and slightly Rosencrantz and Guildensterny, slightly inventing scenes for her when she was she's out of the picture. So, you know, what was she doing while her husband and son are massacring all her suitors? That's a point where she's not in the frame for Homer. She's been sent upstairs. But for me, one followed Penelope upstairs. But yes, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. God, was it fun? No, it was torture. It was incredibly hard. But now, now it's all over.
Now that it is all over, do you have any future plans for any other classically inspired books or anything?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, funnily enough, I'm not in a tremendous rush. I don't know whether that's a pandemic thing, that I just feel like I need to kind of sit and wait until this wretched business is all over before I can sort of take breath, or I have actually got an idea brewing, which I'm not going to tell you about in any detail because it really might not happen, and I'm not sure whether it's a good idea or not, but it would be something quite different again. And I do quite like something, doing something different every time, I have to say. So it might be a bit more, I have classics in it. I think most of my books, except for one, which was The Guardian Project about the BBC, everything's had classics in it. So it'll always have classics. I think we'll have classics in it, but it might not be quite like this. Who knows? Who knows? We'll see.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was really brilliant.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Critic Books podcast. Follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts to never miss an episode.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.